Hi, I'm Johan, and this is the Value Paths podcast. This episode is going to be a little different. To give you a look at how self-serve founders approach building their businesses and growing their revenue, here's a recent conversation I had with Spencer Fry, the CEO and founder of Podia. Spencer is just a natural entrepreneur. He started his first company in 2003 and built two others before he started his fourth, Podia, in 2014. Podia has since become a truly aspirational brand in SaaS, and it's purely self-serve. To tell you a little bit about Podia, it's an all-in-one tool for anyone who wants to create and sell any kind of digital product online, like a course, a membership, if you want to start a community, sell downloadables, or webinars, or a coaching service, it's all possible with Podia. Today, Podia's got about 30 employees, over hundreds of thousands of total customers, and they're profitable. So without any further ado, roll tape, here's our conversation. Spencer, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat.
I think there's a lot our audience could learn from a self-serve company that's been around for so long and is profitable and has acquired so many users. The growth story is something I'm so excited to dig into. But just to ground the conversation a little bit, tell me a little bit about Podia's goals for the next year.
Yeah, definitely. So one thing that I just realized this year actually is that we've been in business for 9 years. So we're actually approaching our 10th year in business, which is mind-blowing to me. So our goals have changed and shifted a lot over the years. So, you know, pre-COVID, our goals were really just, you know, let's grow as fast as we can. And then during COVID, we actually saw a huge influx of customers, people looking to move their offline businesses to online businesses, you know, start serving their audiences. Since COVID, since the peak of COVID anyway, sales and growth across the entire creator economy has slowed. There was a huge like influx and now it's kind of slowed a bit. So our goals are a little bit different than, you know, maybe your traditional company where we're very much focused on growth, but we're also very much focused on the long term and like what is the creator economy going to look like in 2025 and 2030 and so on. Because a lot of creator companies, they basically raise a lot of money during COVID and now they're not doing so well. But as a profitable company, we're really just looking to, you know, be the last one standing, so to speak, and serve as many customers as we can. So our goal is really just to get better every week, every month, every day, and really plant our flag for where the future is going to be in the creator economy.
Okay, that's super interesting that there can be a difference between the long-term play and short-term growth. Tell us a little bit about that. Where do you see the tension?
So my entire philosophy in building companies, I think when you're first starting out, you know, really it's just about like, how can I grab as much revenue as I can so that I can have a self-sustaining business that's going to be around. But once you've kind of hit your revenue goals and you've grown to a certain size, I start to shift my attention from, you know, short-term growth into long-term. So like, what are the really big ideas that I can introduce into the market through my product that can really 10x us instead of those kind of smaller short-term goals about like, okay, like how many Facebook ads can I run this month? Like how many blog posts can I write? That kind of thing. So my entire focus since the peak of COVID has been about the long-term and where we can position our product to be in the best place to serve creators. So I'm completely long-term focused now. So I don't even look at the numbers day-to-day anymore, which is really funny as a CEO of a startup.
Okay. I'm reading between the lines a little bit here. So tell me if I'm wrong, but has the focus shifted from acquisition growth, like growth via acquisition to growth via product? When you say 10X, you're focused on like making the product relevant for a future that isn't even visible in the short term.
So yeah, just to be clear, I mean, we obviously have a marketing team and we're still right. focused on like acquiring new customers and building up our user base and that kind of thing. But my attention specifically is really about what product, what features can we build? What can we introduce that's not just simply like making this experience slightly better, but how can we really think about making substantial changes that might shock people at first, but yeah. like introduce them to this new way of thinking in terms of how a creator should operate their business online, or at least how we feel like they should. Because a lot of times, like if you're a creator or really any type of customer, you're so focused on what you're trying to do in the now that you're not really thinking about your future even a month out. So it's our goal as a company, and it's actually one of our values, is to think about where the creator is going to be, because they don't have the mental energy and capacity to think about that themselves because they're so fixated on today and getting that next customer to survive.
And how do you think on such a large time scale? Do you find that the people who come to Podia largely pursue the same outcomes and you work backwards from evolving those outcomes?
So it's really tricky, and you're going to make mistakes, right? So you're going to introduce features that you feel are going to be valuable for your customers that may not be, and then you're going right. to have to sunset those features. You know, an example of that was 4 or 5 years ago, we introduced this like scheduling feature where people could, basically it was a replacement for Calendly or Savvy Calendar or those other types of calendar tools, but it was built into the product. But the usage was something like 1% of our customer base, even though it took us like a year to build it. So actually 6 months after that, we just completely stripped it out of the product and just said goodbye. So part of it is just, what are those features that you think can really add value that aren't just, like I said earlier, just updating something slightly. It's really just like, what are those game-changing things that people are going to be wowed by? But you have to be comfortable with making mistakes and feel as if that if you do make a mistake, that you can identify it quickly enough and then remove that mistake from the product, because otherwise you just get a product that has a bunch of features that no one uses. And then one other point about that too is that at our stage, especially as you're looking towards the long-term future of your product and your company, it's not as helpful to take as much customer feedback as you once did. So when you're early on and you're starting out, every single piece of feedback you get from your few hundred customers is really valuable, and it really helps you shape and define who your customer is and what your product is. But as you get larger and you have more customers, you know, like we now have hundreds of thousands of customers, any one individual's feedback about our product is actually not very helpful. And even if, say, 50 people have the same piece of feedback, it's still such a small percentage of our user base that if we were to go and implement that feedback, we're maybe not addressing the larger picture. So whenever we're building product, we always think about, like, how can we build something that will impact the largest percentage of our customers? So it's just a completely different mind shift as you grow.
Right, which is why you're looking at usage numbers, because that mm-hmm. will tell you what percentage of your user base is engaging with the feature.
Exactly, yeah. We look at retention, we look at usage numbers, and then we're also looking at what features are going to have the biggest impact on the, this is sort of like a fuzzy metric, but like on the mental health of our customers, in the sense that, like, can we introduce something that's going to really take a pain point away from their lives and make it easier for them? And that gets them like more bought into our mission, which is really just to create this all-in-one tool for creators where they don't need to sign up for like 3 or 4 different pieces of software. They only need to use our product. So if we can remove one of those pain points, you know, that buys them into our system more.
That makes sense. Tell me a little bit more about usage as this metric. I mean, I understand that you might not have anything else beyond usage to judge features that are not relevant to creators mm-hmm. right now, but will be relevant to creators further into their timeline of selling a digital product. But like, have you always thought of usage as that link between value and revenue?
Yeah, so it's not, you know, it is a metric that we look at, but metrics are tricky because they can always be sliced and diced in different ways, and they have a meaningful impact on your decisions, but they're not, the only thing you should look at. And we have various product principles that we've written internally, which is a list of various things that we follow. And one of them is that metrics like usage data should help inform our decisions, but they shouldn't make our decisions for us. An example of this might be like, we have a feature that's getting some amount of usage, but maybe it's not quite where we want it to be. We'll take a look at like, what are those customers, how are they using it? How happy are they using that feature? How can we expand it into more of our user base? Like, why aren't people using it? So a big example of this actually is our email marketing tool. So we have a built-in email feature that replaces like MailChimp and ConvertKit and ActiveCampaign and all these other ESPs.
Okay.
And the usage is actually really good. It's really high, but it's not a huge percentage of our customer base. But that doesn't mean that it's a bad feature, because the people that are using it are loving it. And so the question then is like, how can we get more of our customers to use it and love it? How can we expand the feature set to grow that feature more? So, you know, that's a big focus of ours this year, actually, is really to build out that email feature.
So there isn't an explicit connection between usage and revenue. Rather, usage is just one of almost a zeitgeist of different metrics that you look at that kind of correlate with revenue.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if people aren't using it, then they're probably not paying for it. So right, there needs to be some amount of usage there.
But it's usage combined with... So when you talk to people to figure out if a particular feature is particularly valuable to them, I mean, it's not like you can talk to thousands of users, right? So
right,
explain how that qualitative element fits into all of this if you can't trust a small number of users.
Yeah. So, you know, as we were smaller, obviously I would talk to more customers. I'm famously known as, in 2018, I spoke to 4,000 customers. Whoa. I don't know how famous, but it was a lot, and it blew up on Twitter for a bit. I was very customer obsessed for a long time, and I still am, but you know, it's almost like if you're a parent, you have one child, you're very obsessed. But if you had 10 children, you have to split your attention more. So as we've grown, I haven't been able to spend as much time with our customers, because even if I was to speak to, say, 4,000 customers in 2023, it would be such a small percentage of our user base. So beyond usage, I also look at, where are we heading, going back to that long-term goal? If our goal is to replace all of the tools that you use to run your creator business, there's a certain number of tools that we need to hit to achieve that. And so even if, say, going back to our email tool, so our email tool, we send hundreds of millions of emails a year, but the usage as a percentage of our customer base is still quite small. But I know that that's a tool that we need to have in our product for us to realize our mission. So even though that's not the largest percentage used feature of our tool, like our digital product selling stuff, specifically online courses and digital downloads, are much larger of a percentage, it's still very important for me to continue to build that out, continue to put resources into that, because my goal one day is for, you know, 100% of our customers to use our email tool.
Okay. So you kind of have the vision of the product and you know what it has to be.
Right.
And whether a feature gets used or not, if it fits into the vision, then it fits into the vision.
Exactly, exactly. And it may take years. You know, like, we've actually had that email tool probably for, so we're 9 years old now, we probably had it for 5 or 6 years. It didn't get much love from us as a product team. We didn't spend much time on it. We didn't spend that many resources on it. But I knew that it was something that was very pivotal for an all-in-one tool. If our customers can't send email to their customers, then, you know, that sort of defeats the purpose. But that being said, you know, the usage was gaining year over year, you know, more emails were sent. And actually over the last couple of years, it's really ballooned in terms of number of emails sent. So it's actually a sort of like a light bulb moment for me where it's like, okay, we now need to shift a lot of resources into email because we can see that sort of spiking in the product. And we know that if we invest more resources, more time, more energy, we can get more people to switch from their current existing ESPs to us. And that will bring in more revenue and more retention.
Gotcha. I'm seeing the long-termness of this.
Yeah, exactly.
As you're
exactly
describing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But let's just say you hit a growth plateau in the coming months. What would be your priority in that case? Like, how would you juggle building out this vision for the product and overcoming the growth plateau in the short term?
So we are in a very unique position, which I'm very happy about, is that we are a profitable company. So, you know, we take in more money than we spend. And I've been very diligent over the last 12 to 18 months, actually specifically since around last March. So March 2022, I saw the writing on the wall that the economy was not going to be the best over the, you know, the coming years. And so I completely stopped hiring. I cut a bunch of expenses that I felt like we didn't need to spend on at the time. You know, I took our Facebook budget, I took our Google AdWords budget to zero. I really try to conserve capital. Whereas I feel like a lot of companies, specifically in the creator space, over the last couple of years, they've been spending just willy-nilly, like growing their team from 10 to 50 or 100 or whatever, raising $20 or $30 million and really got themselves in trouble. And I felt like we had a very sort of position where we could take a defensive approach and we could just continue to like improve our product, improve our support, improve our marketing. And then eventually, as the economy comes around, so whether that's, you know, some economists say the end of 2023, some economists say 2024, who knows? But as long as we are in this defensive position where we're making more money than we were losing, at the end of this, again, back to that long-term thinking, I know we'll be in a position where a lot of these creator companies have had to fold, where we'll come out even stronger. So as long as every week, every month, we're improving the product, releasing great new features, making it better to use, that sort of thing, I know that we're going to come out in a brighter spot. But thankfully, we actually are growing, which is good. Every month we grow. So knock on wood, that continues.
So protect the profitability and keep it profitable by reducing costs rather than aggressively growing the revenue.
Right.
Let's go back in time a little bit and dig into the journey getting to profitability, just to compare what your priorities were when you did have aggressive revenue growth goals and you're trying to get to this place that you're at the moment.
So I've always had a mentality as an entrepreneur of, I have a bank account, it has this much money in it. To raise the amount of money in that bank account, I need to make revenue from customers. So despite the fact that I did raise money for Podia, I've always had that bootstrapping mentality where I've not tried to overspend. Like, how can we do more with less? So even when we had millions of dollars, we tried to keep our headcount low. We tried to stay focused, wear many hats sort of thing. At the same time, I was very aggressive about growing revenue. So, you know, as soon as the product launched, like we had a pricing plan. We weren't one of those companies where it's like, okay, it's free, you know, for the first year or whatever. So I've always been focused on revenue for the longest time. But COVID really spiked our growth. I mean, you know, we grew a lot during COVID.
Okay. So in those days when you were thinking about revenue, and it was all self-serve revenue, right?
Of course, yep.
Right. So, so it was all self-serve revenue. What metrics were you looking at that point? How are you managing your self-serve revenue?
So, you know, basically all SaaS businesses, there's only a few inputs that really matter until you get really, really big. Obviously, the top of the funnel, you know, how many customers can you get to sign up for your product? So at the time we were on a free trial. So, you know, it was free for 14 days. And then after that, you would have to upgrade. Then there's like your conversion rate, like how many of those people can you get to convert to a paid account? And then that's your retention. Like how long can you keep those customers around? And all three levers matter, right? But at different points of the business, you care about different levers. So early on, I was very obsessed with like how many customers or how many people can we get to sign up for this product? Like how many people can we onboard? Because I needed more people to use the product so I could get more feedback, so I could improve it. And then not just on the product side, but also like, who are these customers that are purchasing? So super important for marketing. Like we run a ton of surveys, try to figure out who our customers are. So very obsessed with acquiring customers. Okay. And then at some point that changed a little bit to like, okay, let's take a look at our conversion rate. How can we improve that? I forget our conversion rate back in the day, but then we started building like an onboarding tool to really try to get customers to activate. Like, how can we get them to use these features? Because if they use these features, they're more likely to upgrade. And then more recently, as the companies evolve, so there's almost been like three phases. Now we're very focused on retention. So we have that customer who we want to be around for 10 years. What features and what things can we do to keep that customer around? And then one other thing too, besides retention, we're also very much obsessed right now with expansion revenue. So say that customer is paying us $100 a month. How can we get them to pay us $150 a month?
Is it safe to say that you hit a certain volume in acquisition before you started looking at conversion? Or was that just incidental? You weren't really trying to hit a number before you switch gears?
I think it's almost a feeling that you have as a founder and a CEO at some point. It almost matches or aligns with the sort of not profitability mark, but you sort of have a thing in the market that you know people are enjoying, right? So there's this sort of shift where like, okay, my product sucks. And then one day you're like, all right, actually it's really good and people are starting to love it and I'm getting great reviews on review sites and people are emailing me and stuff like that. And it's almost at that point where you realize that you have something that you want to start shifting your attention from how can I get a ton of people to try out my product to how can I get a bunch of people to convert to my product? Because the first year, honestly, it's like you can get a bunch of people in the door and people are going to try it. People are going to pay and hopefully a lot of people will pay, whatever. But you still are kind of just a baby, you know, like you're not that good. Your product's not that good. And so you really have to kind of continue to mature it and get better.
So when you switch gears to conversion, the main thing you were looking at was activation, like you mentioned.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because I mean, you can't convert a customer if they're not activated, right? Although the funny thing about SaaS is that you actually will convert some customers that never do anything, but they put their credit card down it, which is just very strange to me why anyone would do that. But it is a thing in SaaS. Like there's probably 1 or 2% of all your customers will never use it, but pay for it. It's weird.
Weird.
Yeah. I would never do that, but some people do.
They're convinced.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing you can do about it. I'm convinced.
You're a supporter. I appreciate it.
But digging into activation a little bit, it's a user behavior metric. And I'm guessing based on what you said, you looked at certain features that were really popular with paying customers. And you were like, we want to make new users do this thing as well.
Yeah. So a couple things there. So the first thing is that we finally built onboarding, which was the first time we'd ever built it. For the longest time, you would create an account and you just get dropped into this dashboard and you were basically like, what do I do? Right. And so we built onboarding and it was a very simple flow. And one of the things I'm pretty proud about is that it was uniquely designed for the type of product we serve, where there was a very simple checklist that you could check off of all the things you were looking to do. So, you know, we have a bunch of different features. So that first step of onboarding was like, check off all the things you're looking to do. And based on that, we would customize the email sequence. So for example, if you just chose online courses, you would get a email sequence from us that was all about online courses and very focused and tailored to your needs. And then if you selected more things, it would be different. So we really built this like very customized onboarding process, which served two purposes. So the first one was customize email sequences. But the second one was that we started to get a lot of data from our customers. So their intent is to do this thing. We know that, say, you know, these are made up numbers, but like 60% of our customers are looking to sell an online course. How can we then improve the onboarding for the online course feature that better serves those people? So then we built individual onboarding features for all parts of our product. And we just continued to build that out. And that was actually very successful, especially when you're going from no onboarding to some onboarding.
But did you know, so even if the usage data told you that 60 people were trying to start an online course, did you know whether people who were trying to start an online course were sticking around for longer or giving you more revenue over their lifetimes?
We did. So about a year ago, we hired our first data scientist and she's been fantastic. And she slices and dices all those numbers, puts a bunch of reports together, you know, shares all that data with us. And it does help inform our decisions. And we make changes based on things she suggests. So it might be like, all right, well, this copy was confusing because of this. Let's update that. Or like this button was disabled for some reason. We also use a tool called Full Story, which I like and don't like, by the way, but where we can she monitors like user behavior and tries to spot patterns. And then she'll make suggestions. An example of this was that we had a pricing page in the product where a bunch of customers would go to, but then she noticed that everyone was clicking like a link to view the full pricing page, which would bring them to our marketing site. And so one of her suggestions was like, why don't you put the full pricing page directly in the product? That way you don't get users to switch off to a new browser tab and get lost or whatever. So we did that. And that, for example, increased conversions. So yeah, so we do now really look at the data and we kind of use that to, again, inform a lot of our decisions, but inform, not make.
Right. So what makes the decision? It's intuition?
I mean, being honestly blunt, I make the decision, but you know, not only am I the CEO, but I'm also, you know, the head of product or whatever. And partly why I feel like once I'm no longer the most well-versed and knowledgeable, I will pass that off to someone else on the team. But having been here since the beginning, having seen all of our customers change, having seen our product change, I still have the best intuition for what our customers need. So I still feel like I have the best breadth of knowledge as to what our customers are looking for. So I'm still making most of those decisions, and a lot of it is gut and intuition, but it almost comes naturally to me now, because if you've been working on something for 10 years, you probably have a really good understanding as to what to do next. And I do, basically.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Is there, I'm trying to figure out if there's a system to the intuition, though, if that makes sense.
You know, it's obsession. Honestly, it's really being obsessed with the product you're building and the customers you're serving. And I've always been that way. I mean, I care deeply about their success. I care deeply about my team, the product we're building. Like, I give my all to it. Even 10 years in, like, I'm still checking emails on the weekend, like browsing the site, looking at Figma, checking Basecamp, Slack. Like, I'm still... I work all the day, but I'm not working I'm not actively working at night or weekends or whatever like that, but I'm always passively looking. So I'm just always staying informed and obsessed. And I just really care and still get excited every day, you know, we're improving. Like, I just love feature launches, like more feature launches, please. Like, all the time.
Okay. Let's switch gears and talk about the retention setup. What are the kind of retention metrics that you look at?
Yeah. I mean, it's very simple, just to boil it down, you know, it's how long do customers stay on the platform? And then we always look at it based on cohorts. So this month compared to the previous month, compared to the previous month, and so on back in history. And we're always trying to get that percentage up. So say, for example, just a made up number, but after 12 months, 50% of our customers are gone, as an example. So like, how can I, the next cohort, make it only 49% are gone, and then 48% gone, and so on and so on and so on. So it's really about just increasing the retention there based on cohorts. And it's really actually easy for you to see how it improves over time. Okay. And then to improve it, it's really a lot about user interviews, talking to this customer like, hey, you just left our platform. Like, why did you leave? And you know, you get various answers. You get answers from, hey, I'm no longer running this business, or I haven't made any sales, or I'm switching to a competitor, or this feature didn't work well for me. And then it's really just about taking and absorbing all that data and then actively looking to solve some of those problems. And then as you continue to solve those problems, hopefully fewer people are going to churn out. But that being said, like, there's always going to be churn. Like, you're never going to have 100% retention unless like you're selling software to the government or something.
Okay. So just to clarify, when you say cohorts from month to month, are you talking about the number of people that signed up in that month? And then you're looking at how that set of people did in the next month?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And the month after that, and the month after that, and so on. So, you know, there's a fancy chart that you can generate that looks at the cohort retention for every monthly group of customers you've had for time. But usually just like the last couple of years matter, because the cohort from 3 or 4 years ago is less relevant to what you're building today and like who signed up then versus now.
Okay, so you've got the cohorts and you're trying to make sure that the more recent cohorts perform better churn-wise than the cohorts that have come before them.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really one of the main ways that you can track your improvements over time. It's not foolproof, because it could be that, say, 1,000 people that signed up this month are just a better fit for your product than the 1,000 people that signed up last year. So it's not necessarily, again, like, data is great. Data helps inform your decision making, but it's never going to tell you the absolute answer. But it is one way you can look at it to inform, like, okay, things are working here.
Okay. Okay. I'm glad you brought that up, fit with the product, because I assume that each cohort, like a month's worth of users, has a bunch of different kinds of users who are seeking different kinds of outcomes with Podia, right?
Exactly. You actually nailed something. It's like, our business is very hard to look at the data and have a complete story of exactly what's going on, because most products are like single feature products. Like, you're just an email service provider, whereas we do so many different things. We have so many different types of customers that, again, it's difficult to look at the data and really get a lot of good answers out of it.
Management wise, again, like, I'm kind of dancing around this question. But management-wise, how do you deal with that? Intuition and being obsessed with customers, it makes sense, you know, like pay attention to all of the signals you're getting outside of the data. But on a systems level, how do you decide what to improve and which customers? Okay, a better way to ask this question is, do you specifically design for your most profitable segments of users?
That's a great question. We don't, and I'll explain why, because one of the things that's unique to our platform, I'm going to get back to your previous question too, because I have something to add there, but one of the things that's unique to our platform is that we don't take a percentage of our customers, our creators' earnings. We just take a flat fee. You know, whether you're making $2 million a year on our platform or $2 a year on our platform, you tend to pay us about the same amount of money. So we don't necessarily prioritize the people that are big customers versus the small ones. We actually, one of our principles, again, going back to it, our values anyway, is treat everyone equally in terms of our customers, whether you're new or whatever. But in terms of your question of like, so how do we manage all the features and like, how do we build this and how do we know what to build? So a lot of it was, you know, intuition. And then I actually took all the things in my head and wrote down this internal document about what are our product principles. And one of those is that we have a bunch, but one of those is that a goal for us for every single feature that we have, and we have these big, we have basically four big features. We have our website builder, we have our email product, and we have our digital products feature. And digital products has courses, downloads, everything in it. So we have these three major features. And the goal for us is really to get to 80% of what, say, like Squarespace offers in terms of website tooling, and not worry about the 20% fluff that like no one really cares about. But what we have to do then is we really have to be diligent about like what features we build. So currently we're working on building like themes and templates as like a part of our website feature. And so it's like, what are the most important pieces of that tool that we can build? And it actually really helps us focus because we don't get caught in the details. Like, you know, some of our customers are like, I really want custom HTML and CSS editing. And that's a feature we're never going to build because we're not going to do that 20%. We're just going to focus on the 80% of most important feature set for that. But there's this natural progression because say the next two quarters, we focus on a website builder. Okay, so we've done that. Now we have to shift over to digital products and we got to spend the next couple quarters on that. And then, okay, now we've done that. Like now let's go over to the email marketing and then like, let's repeat ourselves. So then let's go back to this. And then so it's almost like it's a natural flow where like, you know, something becomes a little bit outdated. So then we go back and we update it and add to it and stuff like that. But it's always sort of like a merry-go-round, like we're just going from one to the other.
Okay. And shifting between the big buckets kind of covers the problems that the majority of the user base might have.
Exactly. So as the development team has grown, so when we were really small, you know, just 3-4 developers, we really could only focus on one feature at a time. But right now, you know, we're, I always forget the number, but we're like 12 or 13 developers. So we're able to focus on 2 or 3 features at a time. So basically, like right now, for example, we're working on our email product and we're also working on our website builder. And we also have another set of developers working on smaller improvements throughout the product that are more short-term gains, less long-term gains. So, you know, as our development team expands, we're able to cover more parts of the product.
Do you look at LTV as well?
We do, but it actually hasn't changed that much for us over the last few years. So it's just like this steady number because once you get to a certain number of paying customers, tens of thousands, and your pricing doesn't change that much and you don't have much expansion revenue opportunities, your LTV kind of stays flat. But we actually are introducing some big expansion opportunities this year. So, you know, obviously we're hoping that will be a number that we're going to watch more once those expansion revenue opportunities come to market.
Okay. So LTV as an average doesn't fluctuate too much, but I imagine retention does, right? Do certain segments of users stick around for longer than others?
They do. But again, once you get to a certain scale, the fluctuation is not huge. Like you're not going to go from 5 percentage point fluctuation, you know, every month or every year.
Okay. Wow, this has been great, Spencer, to dig into the story, getting to this great place that you're in at the moment where you can think long-term about building the ideal vision of the product.
Yeah, it's. I recommend every entrepreneur, I know it's everyone's goal when you start a business, but get to a point where you are at least sort of like cash flow positive, and then completely shift your attention from how can I get the next dollar to like how can I really grow the business and focus on the long-term vision. So, you know, one more note on that before we go. You know, I have a brainstorm with my COO every 3 months, and our last one at the start of the year was like, what is our plan for 2023, 2024, and 2025, and all the way up to 2030. Obviously, like loose plans, you know, it's good to know where your North Star is so that you can start to work towards it.
And it's so interesting that that North Star is an ideal vision of the product and not
revenue. Yeah, no, it's funny. I was listening to an interview with Mr. Beast, who is like the number one YouTuber, and he said something that I found was like really smart, but simple. He said that my only goal is to create the very best video content on the internet. And if I do that, everything else is going to come. So same thing for me. It's like, how do I create the very best product for our market? And then everything else is going to follow. Like, I know if we do these things, our revenue is going to grow, you know, which is a nice way to think about it.
Right. But then you also need your very specific brand of intuition, which not a lot of people have. Yeah.
No, it just takes time and practice. Again, like I've been doing this for 20 years now, building internet businesses. So it's really just about reps. It's about years. It's about just focusing on what's most important, not just for today, but like what's most important for a year from now or 2 years from now and that sort of thing.
And also the intuition to put the right data points together. And when I say data points, I'm talking about that zeitgeist of which data is just one small part.
Exactly. Yep. Right. Yeah.
The right Don't signals to pay
obsess on any one thing, you know?
Yeah, that was great. I'm trying to think of some closing things to cover, but I think we covered everything I wanted to, at least. And I think anyone listening has got a ton of insights out of how you run things, Zeporia. Thanks so much for taking the time to share it all with us, Spencer.
You're very welcome. And thanks for having me.
If you'd like to join in the discussion, it's happening at selfservesaas.com. And we will also be talking about this episode on LinkedIn. So you can join us there. Thanks so much for tuning in. And until next time, keep fighting the good fight.